So welcome everyone to our pre-Tisha B'Av class 5782-2022. The title of the class is The Real Story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. So before we go into the actual story, which I'm going to share with you from the Gemara, I want to give a little background into the nature of Tisha B'Av. So we know that Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, was a day designated as the day of tragedy. Because the Jewish people in the Midbar, in the wilderness, responded with a bichiyah shachinam, a baseless cry, woe unto us, God, in the aftermath of the Meraglim, the nefarious report from the spies, the 10 spies who got together during their 40-day, 40-night sojourn into the land of Israel and planned to malign the land of Israel. So instead of responding with the appropriate response, which would have been simcha, joy, they cried. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God hears the cry. He says, what? I hear a bechia, but what basis is this cry for? It's a baseless cry. If you are intent on crying for no reason, ek balahem bechia ledorot, I will firmly establish a legitimate reason to cry forever. This night, the ninth of Av, will be designated as a day of tragedy for the Jewish people, for always. And so that is the nature of Tisha B'Av. It came as a response, if you will, to our cry to God, which was baseless. We're using the word chinam, which really means free, free from objective reality. And we know that we lost many, many Jewish people on this day. First and foremost, of course, we connect the day to the loss of the temples. The two Beis HaMikdashot, the two temples, were destroyed first in the year 592 before the Common Era, the second temple in the year 70 after the beginning of the Common Era, and each of those temples was lost on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth of Av. So the ninth of Av is literally the source for all sadness and sorrow in our world. And the loss of the temple specifically is that source, as we'll touch on in a moment. And then additionally, throughout history, throughout the 2,000 some years, since the loss of the second temple, the Beis HaMikdash, we have had wars. World War I began on Tisha B'Av, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, 1492, again, Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, onward and tragically downward. Now, let me just teach you something which I find both meaningful, and I hope that you will find meaningful, also uplifting and profound. When someone is a mourner, when someone is an avelus, there is a special mitzvah, there's a special commandment, to wish that person to chumim, comfort. And it's a special verse that we say to the mourner. We say it for the first time at the cemetery as we are leaving, when we form two lines and the mourners walk between the lines as they transition from the pain of the immediacy of the loss, the aninus, to avelus, to the mourning period, and then they go to the shivas. And throughout shiva, whenever we bid adieu, if you would, to the mourners, we don't say shalom. We don't say goodbye in that formal way. Rather, we say hamakom yinachem eschem. May God the Omnipresent grant comfort to you. Along with the others who are mourning for Zion and Jerusalem. So, unfortunately, sadly, each of us have probably been on the receiving end of that verse in our lives. But did you ever think of the end of that verse, what that means? Please listen. May God the Omnipresent comfort you. But we don't stop there. Bisoch, amongst, sha'ar, those other people, aveleit Zion v'Yerushalayim, who are mourners of Zion and Jerusalem. Who are we speaking about? We're speaking about all the Jewish people. and the fact that we are all mourners on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth of Av, as we are mourning the loss and the continued lack of rebuilding of our temple. That's what it means. B'soch sha'ar aveilei tzion v'Yerushalayim. So we are saying to the mourner an unbelievable statement. We're saying that your loss, your mom, your dad, your ima, your abba, your spouse, God forbid, a child, a sibling, their loss, which is a local loss, we are uplifting that local loss, if you will, and connecting it to the state of the universal loss for all the Jewish people. Because we're all mourners on Tisha B'Av. We're all bereft of our temple. And on Tisha B'Av itself, the ninth of Av, we sit in ash and sackcloth on the floor as mourners do in the low chairs. We're all mourning. So we're saying to the mourner that your state now, where you are low, where you are in a state of mourning, we share this status, if you will, with all the Jewish people who have mourned for Zion and Jerusalem. So it's a very beautiful idea because it uplifts the mourner's personal loss and universalizes it. But it also shows us that the makor, the source for all death, for all loss, is rooted in the ninth of Av. So it's a very powerful idea that I wanted to share with you before we begin, if you will, the rest of the class. So I know that there's one phrase that we're familiar with. We've spoken about it before in different contexts. So this is the crux of what I want to speak about tonight. Sinas chinam, baseless hatred. And the approach I'm going to have tonight is going to be a little different. Because was there baseless hatred in the time of the temple? 100%. Was sinas chinam, baseless hatred, responsible for the destruction of our temple? 100%. In temple number 2, it was there. It was really not clearly present in the destruction of temple number 1. There, the rabbis cite the capital offenses: bloodletting, idolatry, and immorality. Those are the three big ones: pritzas, avodah zarah, and rechitza. They are the ones that were cited. But remember, when the first temple is lost, it took a mere 70 years. I know it's a long time, but relative to how long it's been since the second temple, it's nothing. 70 years it took before Esther and the Jewish people, their progeny, came back after the story in the book of Esther, Purim, and rebuilt that second temple. And yet, the destruction of and the loss of number 2, it's still with us ad hayom hazeh, to this very day. We've never successfully addressed the issues at hand. And there are gray areas, difficult, shaded little areas to address. And perhaps that's why we've never successfully addressed it. Hi Raya, what is the proof that we've never successfully addressed it? We don't have temple number 3 yet. So it's clear that we have not successfully addressed those issues. So sinas chinam, baseless hatred, was undoubtedly a root cause for the loss of temple number 2. No question. But that said, the story that we're going to dissect tonight, have a little fun with, but maybe in a more of a dark way, but try to make it a little lighter. The story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa is often, as they would say in Canada, often, it is often connected with sinas chinam, baseless hatred. And I believe this is erroneous. It's not really true. Meaning, yes, there was baseless hatred. Gemara elsewhere discusses baseless hatred, sinas chinam. But it's not really the issue at hand when we deal with the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. Okay? So I'm going to read for you in the English translation that I have in front of me, and just to make it more user-friendly, I'll send the source sheet out later when I send the copy of the audio portion of the class. But I don't want to fill up my screen just with images that are going to be hard to read. I'd rather just read it to you. the English, but I'll intersperse it with the Hebrew. Okay? So there's a famous pasuk, a famous verse. Ashrei ish hamefachei tamid. Happy, joyous is the individual who's always scared. Umakshe es libo, and one who hardens their heart, yipol bera'ah. It says in Koheles, Ecclesiastes, happy is the one who is always worried, and the one who hardens their heart will undoubtedly fall into evil. And Rabbi Yochanan, the great Jerusalem Talmud editor, says, what is illustrative of this phrase, that Ashrei ish hamefachei tamid, happy, like Ashrei yoshev esecha, joyous is the one who's always worried about things, who's always nervous about what might happen. What is illustrative of this? Like, what is paradigmatic, I guess is a good word for it, of this phrase in Koheles? Listen to this. As a result of the incident of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. Because of a rooster and a hen, Turim Malka was destroyed. And because of the shaft of a sedan, Beitar was destroyed. Now, before we begin, let me prove to you that this story is not about sinas chinam, baseless hatred. As we will see, the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa has elements of baseless hatred. I'll point them out. However, when Rabbi Yochanan is saying, what is illustrative, what is paradigmatic of the phrase Ashri Ish Mefache Tamed, that joyous is the one who's always worried about their actions and what will be, he connects not just the story of Bar Kamsa, Kamsa Bar Kamsa, but he connects all three stories. He taught there's a story about a rooster and a hen that we'll speak about a little later, and there's a story about the shaft of a sedan. There was a Cadillac that got into a car accident. Well, kind of. Those three stories together illustrate one who is always looking with worry at the future. So again, even if Kamsa Bar Kamsa has elements of sinas chinam, baseless hatred, the fact that Rabbi Yochanan is connecting not one event, not just Kamsa Bar Kamsa, but he's speaking about the three in a thematic element that are present in all three, it's clear, as you will see, that there's no sinas chinam. There's no baseless hatred at all in the other two stories. So the point of this entire sugya, this entire piece of Gemara, the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa and the others, cannot be limited just to baseless hatred. There must be something else that caused the destruction of our temple, and that is the rue of our days and why we do not have our temple yet. Okay? So now here's the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. You're all familiar with it. I'll sort of tell it out. Now, all of this, by the way, you can find it inside Maseches Gittin, in the Babylonian Talmud tractate Gittin, which primarily deals with divorce. And it is on Nun He Amid Beis and Nun Vav Amid Aleph, 55b and 56a. So again, I know you'll go to your sources when you choose to learn it yourselves, and you'll go through it, you'll see it all written inside. So I'm going to paraphrase the story for the sake of expedience. So here's the story. So the Gemara said that there were three events that are illustrative of the idea that a person should always be worried about the future, should always be scared about their actions and what they will mean for the future. And Kamsa Bar Kamsa is the first story, and it's the one that they treat in the Gemara and the Talmud at greatest length. So here's the story. In Jerusalem, there was a Jewish man. We never know his name. The Gemara never tells us who he was. He was obviously a prominent Jewish man, very wealthy, very connected, both in the Jewish world and perhaps even among the Romans who were occupying Israel at that time. And this predates the actual Churban. In other words, the destruction in the year 70 came many years after the Romans already were occupying, if you will, what was known as Palestine, renamed as Eretz Yisrael to Palestine, as a shtoch, if you will, for the Romans to put down the Jews. Why not name it after the Plishtim, the biblical Philistines who were such a pain in the side of the Jews? That's what the Romans did. So in the story, there's this wealthy, unnamed Jew, and his best friend and bosom buddy was a man named Kamsa. And his most hated adversary was a man named Bar Kamsa. And the man, the rich Jew, decides to throw a banquet, the party of the year, a who's who of Jerusalem and Israel, fame and fortune, are going to attend this party. And he goes to his trusted servant, who is trusted, yes, but dumb, just the same. And he says to his trusted servant, he says, look, it's not enough to just send the invitation to my bosom pal, lifelong buddy, Kamsa. I want you to go on my behalf, says this unnamed wealthy Jew, and invite my best friend, Kamsa, to attend my party. Of course, a personal invite. And so the man, the servant, leaves the unnamed Jew's presence, and he gets confused. He's a little sedate. And instead of going to invite Kamsa, his master's pal, he goes to the enemy's home, Bar Kamsa, and he extends an invitation to Bar Kamsa to come to the banquet of the year. Now, unbeknownst to the Balabais, if you will, to the one running the party, he's expecting his friend Kamsa to be there. Now, why would Bar Kamsa go? If there's such animus between Bar Kamsa and this wealthy Jew, you could ask, well, what was his intent? Why would he attend? So again, I'm throwing out an idea. I'm sure there are other equally valid approaches. But perhaps he felt that it wasn't a mistake, and that the invitation, the personal invite from the unnamed rich Jew, was an overture. He was reaching out his hand across the aisle and saying, you know, let's have a rapprochement. Let's get together. Let's let the past be the past, and let's make up. So perhaps that was the reason that Bar Kamsa even deigned to attend this party. So nevertheless, he attends, and he comes early, right? Really early. The paparazzi outside on the sidewalks are just getting their cameras ready to take pictures of all the attendees. And along comes Bar Kamsa. He comes in, and they seat him, because remember, he has the personal, probably gold embossed invitation. And he's seated at a very prominent area. So when the rich Jew who invited everyone to his party comes in, probably sort of socially late, if you will, for his own event, and he sees Bar Kamsa sitting at the party. And he is astounded. He is shocked. But listen to how he speaks about his shock. It's very weird. He doesn't speak about it first person. He speaks about it like a third person detached narrative. Now, if there was real hatred, then there should have been more of a visceral reaction. But there wasn't. It was almost very sort of machshava oriented. It was very methodical and planned out in his mind, almost like he wasn't reacting in a visceral way with real anger, but it was more of a thought process. So he says, Michti. Let me think about this. Let's investigate. Usually when the Gemara says Michti, it means, you know, let's analyze the situation. So he's analyzing. He says, you know, there's a guy, myself, who has a friend, Kamsa, and an enemy, Bar Kamsa. What is my enemy doing at my party? Again, it's a very strange way for the Gemara to tell over this story. It's almost like there's a detachment from the Balabais, the one making the party, and his anger. Is it real anger that he's addressing now? It's not clear. Anyways, we'll come back to that. He goes over to Bar Kamsa, and he says, why are you here? Get out. So obviously at that moment, all has been stripped bare. And it's clear now to Bar Kamsa that no. This is not a rapprochement. This is not an olive branch. This was a mistake. But he says under his breath to the adversary, the man running the party, says, look, I understand I'm here by mistake. I get it. But I'm here nonetheless. Please, he said, don't embarrass me. There's a who's who of everyone who's here. Please, don't shame me. I will gladly pay top shekel for all the food and drink that I take for myself. But please, just since I'm here, let me stay. I'll quietly exit stage left a little later on tonight. No, says the party host. Get out now. Pook, leave. Okay. I'll pay for half the total cost of everything for tonight's Sa'uda, tonight's gala affair. Please don't embarrass me. Get out! Okay, fine. I'll pay for everything. Here's my my Canon Express platinum card with an unlimited credit line. Just let the caterer and whoever else swipe my card. Please, Bar Kamsa says, don't embarrass me. Get out. And he picks him up bodily. I'm sure Nunzio and Guido are there. You know, it is the Roman Empire, so there's Romans there. So Guido and Nunzio come up, and they pick up Bar Kamsa, one hand each, and they take him out, and they summarily toss him out on the street, literally on the road. So he gets up, he's dusting himself off. The paparazzi, I'm sure, are taking nice pictures of this humiliation, this very public bouchat. Now, let's stop for a moment. Let's just stop. So at the moment where Bar Kamsa realizes that it's a mistake, he's pleading, please don't embarrass me. And the rabbis say, you know, this is a powerful moment because you never embarrass someone in public. Hamevayish berabim, one who embarrasses a Jew publicly, ein lahem chelek l'olam haba. They lose the entirety of their portion in the next world. And we compare public shaming to death itself. And it makes a lot of sense, because think about it for a moment. If you've ever been embarrassed, we've all had moments where, you know, little things, hopefully not big things, happen. You turn white as a sheet. All the blood tends to drain from your face in your embarrassment. And perhaps that's what the rabbis are saying, that you become for a moment without blood, like a mace, like someone who's dead. Wow, it's a powerful moment. So what was the response of the partygoer, the party maker? We know Bar Kamsa's begging, and he says no. But again, he said it with a very disattached way. Nichti, let's think about it. Like as if he's not responding viscerally, but without emotion, very analytically. So let me offer one approach. I'm sure there are others. That perhaps this is the sinas chinam of the story. Maybe this is the baseless hatred moment. Why did the party maker have such contempt for Bar Kamsa? You know why? Because of Kamsa, his friend. The real hatred, the real animus, and maybe it was with merit. Maybe Bar Kamsa was such a lowlife, as we'll see in a moment. He was an extraordinarily wicked human being. And maybe if you knew him, you would hate him also. Maybe there'd be a mitzvah to hate him because he was a horrible human being who was going to consign the Jewish people to destruction. What kind of human being would kill his own people? So no question Bar Kamsa was a lowlife. But the party maker doesn't have a personal bone to pick with Bar Kamsa. That's why he speaks in a disattached way. It's almost like he's saying, I'm supposed to not like this guy. Okay, fine, I'll treat him with contempt. Perhaps it was the relationship that the unnamed Jew had to Kamsa, his pal, who hated Bar Kamsa. If you want in with Kamsa, you must hate Bar Kamsa. So that would be, undoubtedly, Sinas Chinam, where the party owner, he doesn't have any bone to pick with Bar Kamsa. He's treating Bar Kamsa with such humiliation, not out of anything that was done to him personally, but out of a misplaced loyalty and fidelity to his friend Kamsa. And that would also answer another question, which may or may not have ever entered your mind. It's a delightful question. Ready? What is the story always called? We never call it the party maker and Bar Kamsa. No. It's always called Kamsa, Bar Kamsa. Let me ask you a question. Why does Kamsa have to be associated with this vicious Bar Kamsa character? Think about it. Kamsa never showed up in the whole story, right? He never got his invitation. He didn't even come to the banquet. It should be a story about the banquet maker and the Bar Kamsa character. Why do we not say that? No, we say Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. So perhaps one approach is that, again, the hatred that Kamsa had for Bar Kamsa instigated the reaction of the mysterious unnamed host to throw out Bar Kamsa. And therefore, the rabbis are tying Kamsa with Bar Kamsa because it was his fomenting the rage of the party owner, party host, to hate Bar Kamsa that initiated the entire tragic process. So therefore, the rabbis are saying, no, Kamsa doesn't get a free pass, even though I understand he didn't show up physically, but his hands were all over this horrible, tragic story. That makes a lot of sense, right? I think it's a really unique way, and I think that's a very powerful proof that we always call the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa. Now, you know what is equally amazing? And I want you to file this away, and I'll come back to this a little later. I like to do this, okay? Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are words used in the Talmud for very trivial little things. A kamsa is like an insect, like a bug. It's used elsewhere in the Talmud. A bug. And a bar kamsa, well, those of you who know Hebrew, right? You have your bar mitzvah, a son of a mitzvah. So what would a bar kamsa be? He'd be the son of a bug. He's not even a bug. He's just the son of a bug, the offspring of the bug. So maybe the rabbis are trying to tell us that a kamsa ubar kamsa, over trivial insect, bug-like, crazy, dumb ideas and values that have no place in Judaism, over little trivial interpersonal relationships, Jerusalem is gone. And I think that that's a very big part of the story. We'll come back to that a little later. Okay? So what happens next? Let's go outside of the banquet hall, shall we? So Bar Kamsa picks himself up, dusts the dirt off. They didn't have paved roads back then. And he starts to walk away, and his rage knows no limitations. And he thinks to himself, huh, the rabbis sat at that party inside. They saw my plight. They saw me begging the party owner to not embarrass me. And now one of the rabbis stood up to defend me. Now you notice how delightful he is, right? There was a room full of people. Rabbis and non-rabbis from the Jewish world. There were Roman dignitaries. Everybody's there. The only thing he pinpoints, the rabbis are there. Now, you may say, well, why didn't the rabbis stand up for him? Okay, it's a legitimate question. That even if the man was a Rasha Marusha, this wicked human being as we discussed, and yes, he might have been beneath contempt, maybe the rabbis should have stood up for him. But then again, knowing what he does after the fact, maybe it's reasonable that they wouldn't stand up for such a human being. I don't know. That's a debate that you'll have. So Bar Kamsa then says to himself, see, there's a lot of thought process here going on. First we have the party maker, and now we have Bar Kamsa's thought process. So he says to himself, the rabbis were there and said nothing in my defense. So I'm going to kill all the Jews, the rabbis and everybody. I'm going to destroy it all. Bar Kamsa had a relationship with Rome. And that relationship allowed him to plot an evil, nefarious, but genius plan to destroy the Jews. So he informs Caesar, It's not clear if Caesar literally in Rome or Caesar's underling who was in charge of Judea, Samaria, you know, that area of Jerusalem. It's not clear at all. But Caesar gets wind of a report from Bar Kamsa. And Bar Kamsa has schlep, you know, he has in with Caesar. And he says, Yehuda, the Jewish people are rebelling against you. They don't respect you. No respect at all, Mr. Caesar. And Caesar says, what do you mean? Well, I haven't had any issues like this. Why do you say this, Bar Kamsa? In other words, he's not taking Bar Kamsa at his word, because Bar Kamsa is a lowlife, and I'm sure Caesar himself also realizes, yeah, Bar Kamsa is a useful idiot, but he's not to be trusted. So before I go and get hot under the collar, Caesar says, you know, what proof, Bar Kamsa, do you have that Judah, remember, this is the southern kingdom of Judah, Yehuda. So it's interesting that we're not called the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, because the northern kingdom of Israel has been destroyed, lost. So we're really the southern kingdom of Judah. That's what's left. Why do you say, what's your proof, Bar Kamsa, that this is true? So Bar Kamsa says, make a test. I will show you. You'll show yourself. You'll prove 100% to yourself that the Jews have no respect for you. Send them a fattened calf to offer in their temple, the beautiful temple where they bring karbanos, sacrifices to God. Send them your best calf. Say it's a gift from Caesar. See what they do with your calf. So what does Caesar do? He sends his calf. But he sends his calf, apparently, with Bar Kamsa and the group accompanying the calf. The calf's alive. He's fat and juicy, but he's alive and well. And so Bar Kamsa waits for a quiet moment, and he takes like a little Swiss pocket knife, and he makes a little cut, very, very minuscule, either, the rabbis say, by the eye or by the lip of the behemoth, of the little calf. A place that to the Romans would be so insignificant as to not qualify as a disqualifying mum, as a blemish. But when the rabbis, when the kohanim, when the priests would take out their electron microscope and do their bedika, they would check the carbon, the sacrifice from head to toe, they would surely find the mum, the blemish. And that blemish disqualified that animal from being a korban. It has to be tamim. It has to be pure, unadulterated. It has to be without a mum, without a blemish. So what happens? Bar Kamsa makes the blemish. The calf goes to the rabbis of Jerusalem, and sure enough, they check it out, and they find the blemish. And there's a huge discussion, because this is a serious issue. What do we do with Caesar's calf? So most of the rabbis, in fact, all of the rabbis but one say, you know, for Shlom HaMalchus, for having peaceful, cordial relations with Caesar and the Romans, let's make a one-time exception. And just this one time, allow this blemished calf up on the temple. It should be brought as a sacrifice. And one rabbi, his name was Rabbi Zachariah ben Ofkelus, who was the most respected, apparently, of the rabbis in the debate, he takes a contrary position. He says, no. Chas v'shalom, he says, God forbid. If we make this one-time exception, word will get out that a blemished animal was brought, consecrated, and brought as a korban, as a sacrifice. It will delegitimize the temple and all sacrifices for the future. Can't do it. So the rabbis get together again, and they debate, and they say, you know, plan A, Rav Zachariah, you rejected it. We wanted to bring it for peace. You said no. Then we only have plan B. We need to whack Bar Kamsa. We need to take him out. We need to kill him. We can't allow Bar Kamsa to go back and report to Caesar that we denied the sacrifice. Otherwise, we're dead. We don't know, but it's going to be horrible. And what again does Rabbi Zachariah say? Unbelievably? No. You can't kill Bar Kamsa. because making a blemish on a consecrated animal is not a death penalty case. People will be under the misconception that it is a death penalty case, and we don't want people, God forbid, to get the wrong impression, so we can't do it. So they don't bring the animal, and they don't take care of Bar Kamsa before he can report it. So what happens? Bar Kamsa goes back to Caesar. He reports that the Jewish people rejected his gift. To Caesar, it was a perfect gift. And so the Gemara ends the saga of Kamsa Bar Kamsa, that because of the misplaced humility of Reb Zechariah ben Ofkelus, Rabbi Yochanan, the same mandamer, the same spokesman, who began by talking about what is the illustrative of the one who is always scared, he says, because of Rabbi Zechariah's inaction, everything was destroyed. The temple, all burned and gone. He lays the blame on Rabbi Zechariah. Now I ask the following question. What did Rabbi Zechariah do that wasn't in keeping with what the verse in Koheles and Ecclesiastes told us? It says, Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid. You always have to be scared about the future. Well, who was more scared than Rabbi Zechariah? Oh my gosh, he was so terrified. If you bring the animal, people will get the wrong impression that you can bring blemished animals. If you don't bring the animal, people will, and you kill Bar Kamsa, people will make the mistake of thinking you get killed. It's your chayv misa, your get death penalty for putting a blemish deliberately on a sacrifice, on a korban. So he's so terrified, he can't even act. It seems to be exactly what Rabbi Yochanan extolled. Or is it? No. You see, when Rabbi Yochanan said we should be worried, he didn't say, only worry till this point and no more. No. When Rabbi Yochanan said be worried about the future, always be conscious and mefached. Be careful of your actions. What might be the byproduct of your actions or inactions? But he didn't say you can artificially stop that worry at any given point. You can't artificially put a limitation on how scared to be. What did Rabbi Zechariah worry about? Oh my gosh, the laws of the temple will be maligned. They will be diminished in people's eyes. The laws of sacrifices, or someone who messes with a sacrifice. Oh my gosh, what will it mean for the karbanos, the sacrifices brought in the future of the temple? Rabbi Zechariah, hello, excuse me. If you don't either allow this one-time sacrifice from Caesar, or take care of Bar Kamsa before he reports the rejection of said sacrifice, there won't be a worry of what people might think about the temple sacrifices anymore. Do you know why? Because there won't be a Beis HaMikdash. Because of your inaction, it's a moot point what people will worry about the laws. There won't be a temple to worry about anymore. There won't be any more sacrifices. So in other words, Rabbi Zechariah was worried, yes. But his worry was only to a certain point, but not beyond. And that tragic inability that Rabbi Zechariah had to be scared but not scared enough, to be fearful but not fearful enough, and to put a limitation on how far he could see down the road, that destroyed the temple. Now, you see very clearly that with the exception of what I pointed out of the relationship between Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, and how perhaps the hatred that Kamsa, who never appears in the story, had for Bar Kamsa, that initiated the party maker's reaction, the non-visceral, non-angry reaction, when he embarrassed and publicly shamed Bar Kamsa. So you see that, except for that moment, which perhaps was sinas chinam, baseless hatred, this story has nothing at all to do with baseless hatred. And I'll prove it to you, because Rabbi Yochanan says there's not one story, it's a trilogy. It relates to two other stories, and I'll tell you very briefly the other stories. The Gemara says, because of a rooster and a hen, Torah Malka was destroyed. What's the story of the rooster and the hen? So apparently, there was a fertility rite in Torah Malka, a very fertile place in northern Israel. And the fertility rite would be is that when a chas and a kala, you had a Jewish bridegroom and his and her groom, the two of them got together. In honor of the bride, they would have a hen, and in honor of the groom, they would have a rooster. They would sort of represent them metaphorically, and I guess they would shech them, and they would have them at the banquet at the Sudas Mitzvah, at the meal, celebrating the union. So along comes a group of Roman soldiers. They're passing by, and they're hungry, and they see some chickens running around. They don't know that this is Foghorn Leghorn and the old granny. Okay, I'm joking. That they were betrothed to each other. They just think they're hungry and they want some Kentucky Fried kosher chicken. So they shech the rooster and the hen, not knowing that they're designated for a certain Jewish couple in this fertility rite. And the Jewish people of Torah Malka attack the group of Roman soldiers. When word gets back to the commander of the group, he believes that the people of Torah Malka, the Jews specifically, are rebelling, and they crush them, and thousands are killed. And what about Beitar? Well, Beitar is the end of the process. It happens years after the Temple of Jerusalem was destroyed. It happens with the Bar Kokhba rebellion. I'm not going to go through all the details, but suffice it to say, hundreds of thousands of Jewish lives were lost in this battle. Bar Kokhba lost, and the Romans revenged themselves. They avenged themselves with a horrific revenge against all the Jews. And Beitar fell, and the bodies were unburied. It's a horrific, horrific story. And what happened with Beitar? What was the impetus for the destruction of Beitar? You ready for this? It was the sedan. It was the shaft of that aforementioned car, the Cadillac. Well, I jest. Apparently, princess, daughter of the ruling Caesar of Israel, she had a chariot. She had a sedan. I believe it actually has a name. It's called like a litter. And it's carried by a group of very strong-shouldered soldiers. And they're carrying her in this beautiful, you know, farpitzed Cadillac sedan. And I guess one of them got a little furmished or something, and they bashed one of the fenders of this sedan, and it got destroyed. And so they're up in Beitar, and they look around, and there are trees there, and they can repair the princess's sedan with one of the trees. They don't know that when a newborn Jewish boy or girl are born into the world of Beitar, that there is a tree planted, a cedar tree for a man, another type of tree for the young lady, and that the trees grow as the little children grow, and when they get married, they cut that tree down and they use it in the chuppah, in the canopy. Beautiful idea. So unbeknownst to the Roman soldiers who just want to fix the princess's Cadillac, they don't know that there's this significant historical import of said tree. They cut down the cedar tree and they make out of it, they fashion replacement parts for the broken sedan. And the people of Beitar go wild and attack the princess and her entourage. You can only imagine when Caesar hears what happened to his daughter, it all goes away. He attacks. The Jews are wiped out. It all is sourced in this story of the broken shaft of the sedan. So you can see very clearly that the common cause of the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa, of Rabbi Zechariah ben Uflus and his inability to see the future clearly, allow the sacrifice or take out Bar Kamsa, because there won't be a Jerusalem next year if you don't look far enough. What about Torah Malka? Yes, I understand they ate Foghorn Leghorn. But don't you understand that if you react and attack Roman soldiers, that there's going to be reprisal? Yes, the princess's sedan cost you a cedar tree that it was designated for a young Jew when he got older. But do you understand that attacking Caesar's daughter and that entourage is going to bring Gehenna? Hell will be let loose upon the Jews of Beitar. So in all three cases that we've cited, there is a commonality. There's the Sad HaShavashapahem, that there's an inability, Haroa Esanolad, to see the product of the future, of my actions and inaction, And let's look one, two, three steps down the pike and try to understand what might happen as a result of my action today. And I believe this is what the Gemara is trying to tell us. And perhaps this is a root cause for all of this destruction. Our Jewish people have always had this inability, apparently, to see down the road far enough. We can see, yes. And we, in the case of Rabbi Zachariah ben Ofkelis, we even try to see what's going to happen. But we're not scared enough. We're not worried enough. We're not seeing the end result. So again, what could that mean for us today? It can mean a lot of things. On a personal level, it's clear that when we do or do not in our own lives, there are repercussions to our actions and inactions. That's clear. And we look at our country, of the United States of America, look at Israel. Clearly, there are so many things happening, and they're happening so fast, that we have to pray to Hashem that the people who are the decision makers above, in Washington and in Jerusalem, that they're Roes Anola, they're not sitting there like Rabbi Zachariah ben Ofkelis, that if they're looking at a very real and present danger with Iran, God forbid, Chas V'Shalom, acquiring an actual nuclear weapon, that they're seeing the nolad, they're looking down the pike, and they're not copying Rabbi Zachariah, who's worried what it could mean, what it could be, but we're going to take action because it's necessary. We're seeing the roes anolad, what might come. So being a mefache tamed, being someone who is consciously aware of the future and is looking at that future, I think is a very powerful remedy, if you will, for the tragedies of Tisha B'Av, and perhaps because we haven't done such a great job of looking down the road enough, perhaps that might be the reason that we haven't been able to bring back the third temple. We haven't been able to rectify this situation the same way that baseless hatred still plagues us as the Jewish people, Ad HaYom HaZeh, to this moment. Perhaps if we can just do better at trying to look a little farther down the road, and God willing, with Hashem's help, and we need Hashem's help, this Tisha B'Av should be our last Tisha B'Av. They say in tradition that Mashiach, that the Messiah himself is going to be born on Tisha B'Av, or created on Tisha B'Av, whatever it might mean. And let's hope that this is the last Tisha B'Av, and that instead of a time of crying and sadness, of bechi, umispet, and eulogy, and lament, that the lament should be turned into dances. As David HaMelech says, we say this every morning in Mizmor Shir, Chanukasa Bais LeDavid. King David says, please God, turn my lament. Thank you for changing. Hafakta Mispedi, you change my lament, my mourning, my hesped, my eulogy, lemacholi, into a dance for me. That again, we should be dancing next year, Jerusalem, together.